I'm very happy now to welcome to our program Carlos Warner. He's an assistant federal defender representing 11 men held without charge at the U.S. Guantanamo Naval Detention Camp in Cuba. Attorney Warner has traveled to Guantanamo approximately 30 times and has been to the base twice since the current hunger strike began on February 6th. Carlos, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Hey, Scott, thank you for having me.
First of all, maybe tell our listeners, and me too, of course, about your role. I mean, you are representing 11 individuals at the Guantanamo Naval Base Detention Camp. Tell us about what your role has been, just so we get a flavor for it, for the struggles you've been in, the legal struggles, and now we have a life and death struggle going on. But tell us your role.
Yeah, they're really not legal struggles. So I was appointed with my colleagues. I couldn't try to represent 11 men in Guantanamo by myself, but I was appointed with my colleagues in 2008 to be habeas counsel, which is a legal role. But it became quickly apparent that this isn't a legal problem because Guantanamo is a legal black hole. So pretty quickly, we shifted our focus to policy and really lobbying, politics. That's the only way that the men will actually be released. So I, although I'm appointed as habeas counsel, I view my role as doing whatever it takes to get my men home, many of which are innocent.
Now, it might be good to explain to our listeners a bit about the hunger strike itself. I've heard that 100 or more of the detainees are engaged in the hunger strike out of the 166 prisoners being held there. Maybe you could clarify that number or confirm it.
It's 130, actually, and we knew this since early February, and I could take you through the history about how we got on this hunger strike. I mean, the root cause, obviously, is the hopelessness of indefinite detention and the disappointment in the president. The military has underestimated and called the number low. I think in February, when we were saying 130, they said 5, and this is a hoax, and now they're up to 100. And they claim that 29 men, I think, as of today, are being tube-fed, but they never say which one, so it's a different 29 men each day. And we know this, actually, their protocol for hunger feeding, which is horrific, was released today. And it says that, you know, men should be probably tube-fed for about 3 to 5 days, yet it's been 29 or thereabouts for 2 weeks now. So we know that basically, you have 130 out of 166 men hunger striking, and likely the vast, vast majority of those men are being tube-fed by our military.
You want to describe a bit about the information released about the process of feeding these detainees via a tube?
Well, I mean, it's you have to put several things together to get the full picture, but it's barbaric. It's against clear violation of medical ethics, and it's been called torture. And what they do is twice a day, they forcibly extract these men from their cells, and they take them to a common area, and they're strapped from head and toe, and the protocol today described that the men are masked, like Hannibal Lecter, I would guess, because these men are engaged in a peaceful hunger strike. They're innocent men, but engaged in a peaceful hunger strike. Many of them don't want to be tube-fed, obviously. So they're strapped down. Doctors won't participate in this process. Instead, you have a technician who's jamming a tube that's too large, and the men ask for a smaller tube, into the nose. They're strapped down and struggling, so often they don't even find the right passage, and there's bleeding. And when they do find the right passage, it's been described as razor blades. When it hits the throat, the men start to gag, have a hard time breathing, and when it goes into the stomach, if the fluid's pumped in too fast, the men vomit almost instantly. And if it's pumped in at a reasonable pace, a half hour or more, their stomach becomes distended, and one of the most tragic things that I've heard is that the hunger pangs come back. After 100 days of hunger striking, the men aren't hungry anymore, but when you're tube-fed, the hunger comes back. And this is happening now to a majority of men in Guantanamo. And we know that a majority of men in Guantanamo are, in fact, innocent, shouldn't be there. I mean, everyone in the government agrees that they shouldn't be there, yet there they are. And they're hunger striking. They're being force-fed. They're on a peaceful hunger strike, and they're being force-fed by a government that will not release them. So it's like a bad Orwellian film when you think about it that way.
Carlos, many of the detainees have been there 10, 11 or more years. Tell us what led to this hunger strike. Was there a particular incident, or was it growing frustration in the fact, as you said just a moment ago, that many of these detainees have been cleared for release, but due to congressional restrictions and White House inaction, they have not been released?
It's actually White House inaction, but let me answer your question about the strike itself. What happened was, in September of last year, the guards switched from the Navy to the Army, and a hardened corps of guards and supervisors came in. And there's a colonel down there who was just exerting his will on the men. And it began, we started hearing things in the 9/11 trials about their cells being emptied out while they were in court. And then we heard about a shooting in early January, which is unheard of. For 4 years, the men had no problems with the guards. There was no conflict at all. But we heard of the shooting, which really came out of left field. And when I was down in early January, my clients told me that Colonel Bogdan and the other Army came in. They took everything out of the cells, and what really finally sparked the hunger strike was linguists that worked with the military were leafing through the Qurans. And this is when everybody went on a hunger strike. And at that time, I said, well, look, you guys can end this now. All you have to do is take very specific steps, which I could tell you if you're interested what the steps are. The military refused to do it, even though they had taken the same steps in the past, and continue to be aggressive towards the men, which have dug them in further and further. It's a nightmare down there. Just last week, I heard now what this military, what these officers are doing. They've ordered that all the men be strip searched now if they come out to take a phone call from their attorneys or talk to their families or have a lawyer meeting. So the men aren't coming out anymore. They're just doing everything that they can to make their lives more difficult, thinking that it's going to break the strike, but it's so nearsighted because it's just causing the men to be more dug in and more unified. This military could completely reverse the course of this hunger strike, but they're so dug in now, that's why we've been calling on the president, because obviously they will listen to nobody, and they are intent on just being very aggressive with the men, and that's just not going to work.
Explain to our listeners a bit about why many of these detainees, and you can certainly enumerate the number, who are cleared for release by several U.S. government agencies, but
all
have not been released.
Yeah. Right. It's unfortunately, and I come from the left. My wife campaigned for President Obama, and certainly I'm a federal defender, but I can't blame the right for this, even though the president enjoys blaming the right, because he has authority under current law to release these men. And for years, he's blamed it on Congress, and the left has been, it's really kind of taken the bait, hook, line, and sinker, despite what the law has been. Senator Levin, who came out last week, inserted the power into the latest version of the NDAA, actually the 2012 version, allowing the president to transfer these men. So it's not about whether or not President Obama has the authority to do it, it's whether or not he has the political courage to do it. And frankly, going back to the days of Rahm Emanuel, he's made a political decision not to close Guantanamo. Why is that? Because over half of the left think it's a good idea to keep it open. Now, this is an ignorant position on part of the public because they don't understand that innocent men are there. They think it's still the worst of the worst, which it has never been. And 85%, I think, of the right think it's a good idea to keep it open. So politically, he has had no motivation to do it. But this isn't a political issue. It's a moral issue. It's one that weighs on his conscience, and it's one that he's just going to have to make. It takes him really getting a big backbone and saying, I'm doing what's right as commander-in-chief. I'm going to close Guantanamo because it's not only right for our country, for our national security, but we as a country can't hold innocent people any longer. But so far, that message has not resonated with the general public. We have some momentum now, but I have to say, after working so many years in this problem, I have to be pessimistic about whether or not the president will actually follow through with his promise.
What do you make of President Obama's comments in reaction to a question about the plight of these detainees on hunger strike at a recent press conference? He talked about his expectation that his administration will eventually close down Guantanamo.
Well, actions speak louder than words. And I saw on his face, you know, I watched the election and I was so frustrated that it just wasn't even mentioned. Nobody was talking about it. But actions speak louder than words. So he says that he's going to do it, but what has he done is my question. And right now he's doing nothing. There used to be an office that was closed in the State Department. The first thing he has to do is appoint a high-level official in the White House to kind of moderate all the disputes that happen between Department of Justice, Department of Defense, and the Secretary of State. Once you need to get somebody in that high-level position that can direct the closure of Guantanamo, because right now there's nobody in the administration that's charged with it. So we need to see action on that. And then the second action, once that person is appointed, obviously, is moving the 86 out. The 86 who have been unanimously declared by all of our intelligence communities and by Department of Justice and FBI, they need to go home now, and those solutions are there now, but we have to make that a political priority. So when I saw his comments, he looked frustrated. He looked like he meant it. I was hopeful that he meant it, but, you know, now I think it's been 2 weeks, and we've still seen nothing. We've seen senators come out and call for it, but we've seen no appointment of the right officials. And certainly the president hasn't intervened on this hunger strike. If the president wanted to end the hunger strike, he could call someone like me or my colleagues, and we could go down and mediate and end to this hunger strike in 1 week. But nobody's there to do it. I mean, that's a frustrating. You have the military driving it forward. You say the president's committed. You have senators coming out. But still, no concrete action. And we can't be waiting months and months and months. This is a dire, dire emergency that has to be resolved before someone dies.
We're speaking with Carlos Warner, an assistant federal defender representing 11 men held without charge at the U.S. Guantanamo Naval Detention Camp in Cuba. Many of these now on hunger strike since February. Carlos, we've heard the president speak of congressional restrictions and withholding of funds to transfer these detainees for release. We've also heard about some onerous restrictions on signing off, guaranteeing these men won't reoffend as terrorists in the future. What is true or not true about some of these excuses or rationales that are used?
It's not true, and it's one of the frustrating things we deal with. In 2012, Senator Levin, who came out last week, gave the president what's called waiver authority, which basically said that if the president deems that the transfer of an individual is in the interest of United States national security, he can authorize, you know, the Secretary of Defense to execute a waiver to allow the person to be transferred. It's unilateral. He doesn't need to go to Congress for that. He just needs to say that he wants it done. And this idea that Congress has blocked him was true before 2012, and there still are congressional restrictions on sending these men to the United States that the president needs to fight. But on the 86, he could transfer them today. And in his comments, he was so clear about why keeping Guantanamo open is against our national security interests, that it creates more terrorists, that it is the main recruiting tool for al-Qaeda and the Taliban, that it interferes with the ability for the president to, you know, talk about human rights in other parts of the world. All those things affect our national security, and they're the reason why he could waive the requirement, the transfer restrictions for the 86 and send them now. And plus, the State Department has already created the solutions for many of these men. Perhaps not all of them, but there could be solutions in the very short term. And when I say the short term, 2-3 months, if you had the right person in charge, the 86 could be out. Then you have a sticky problem with the rest, because you have a bunch of other innocent guys who are ticked off. So the CIA and other agencies won't sign off on them to be released, because although they were innocent, they're ticked off. This is not the 86. that's when the president needs to really assert himself and say, we're going to do what's right. In America, we don't hold people for something they might do in the future. If they can be tried in Article III court, we're going to give them a trial. If not, we're going to release them. They return to the battlefield, we'll deal with them there. That's what our commander-in-chief should be doing in order to close Guantanamo. So the entire process could be wrapped up in a year, like just like it could have in 2009. Now, if you want, I could tell you he does need a fight with Congress to try to loosen up the restrictions to bringing some of these men to the United States, either for trials or otherwise to be released. And the reason why is because that would open up many other diplomatic doors for the president, because there's a lot of states, especially the European states, that are saying, wait a minute, we're not cleaning up your problem. We're not taking anyone unless you'll take some people. And that stalemate has existed for years, but it does not apply to the 86. The first thing he has to do is get them out.
Now, the situation with countries and repatriating some of these men held in Guantanamo to their native countries, we also hear that, and I think you were referring to the fact that some, maybe not all, of those countries have agreed to take these men back. But maybe speak to the roadblocks that are standing in the way of some repatriation if the White House had the will to go through with it.
Well, Yemen, I mean, first of all, the White House could lift its blanket restriction that it placed. Congress didn't place anything on it. The White House said we're not transferring anybody to Yemen. Yemen's a sticky situation, and I want to talk about that if we have time in a second. But on, let's use Kuwait, for example. Kuwait has two remaining men in Guantanamo, and under the eye of the U.S. ambassador, they built a rehabilitation center in Kuwait that will house 25, 30, maybe 35 men. And it was built while they only had two people left in Guantanamo. Why did they build it that big with us watching? Because they are ready to take some of these men and put them through a rehabilitation program. And Kuwait, one of our closest allies in the Middle East, is a great place for them to go because we could keep eyes on them. We could help them. It's a wealthy nation. There's all sorts of benefits to both the Kuwaitis, who would get their citizens back, presumably, you'd think, and also to take some of these other cleared individuals that don't have a place to go. Think of a rehabilitation center like a halfway house. It's not a permanent solution, but it's a place where you can get these men who are safe to release, who've been in prison for 11 years, get them back on their feet, figure out where they're going to go, how they're going to work. During this time, Yemen needs to come up to speed because 56 of these men, of the 86, are from Yemen. And it's unreasonable to think they'll never return back to Yemen. But some of them can now. Yemen can start its own rehabilitation center. And then you'll, again, each case is different. You'll have some men that can't go to Yemen because it would be dangerous if they go back. Well, those are the ones that you put in these other third-party countries like Saudi Arabia, like Qatar, and like Kuwait. I mean, there's many places that they can go right now without Congress. Now, if Congress would see fit to just open the door to a few innocent men coming back here, then we would have a whole different playing field, including the European nations, and many other places.
Carlos Warner is our guest, and you're the defense attorney for 11 of those in Guantanamo who are serving many years without charge or trial. And how many of the detainees that you're representing are cleared for release, and how many are in that limbo state?
Well, we have a cat from every alley. So we have some from in each state. We have, I believe it's four that have been cleared for release, and that's public knowledge. It gets a little bit confusing because there's two different categories of cleared for release, but we have four of them. But none of our men, as you said before, have been charged with anything. So when we get into the innocence discussion, we have the cleared for release where everyone sort of agrees, but then we also have the principle in this country that you are innocent until proven guilty. And if you can't charge them, it's a whole different argument. Let's see the evidence, let's have a trial, and let's test it. The evidence, it's a legal black hole, it remains a legal black hole, but let's be honest, it's a place where the government gets to give its point of view, and then they say, people like me, you can't say anything about why your client may or may not be innocent because we're going to put classification on this material and we're not going to let you talk about it. So that's why it's frustrating, but I have to speak in generalities. But the bottom line is that you have, you, if you ask me, I tell you, I'm representing 11 innocent men. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the best way to describe it.
Now, I've heard that some of the men who are not cleared for release are also deemed too dangerous to release, but
right.
cannot be tried in a military court
that's
because
right.
they have been subject to torture, and that things that evidence or whatever evidence may exist may not be admissible because it was extracted under torture. How true or not true is
no,
that?
I mean, the government has said that there's an amorphous list, and it gets complicated in Guantanamo because you can't charge people in Guantanamo with what's called material-supported terrorism. You could do that in Article III courts. So it's likely a very small handful of individuals in Guantanamo, perhaps even the ones that are currently being tried, that can be charged with an actual crime. Now, it's torture's part of it, but I think the better way to view those that are being indefinitely detained is that, well, they're people that are angry. They're angry, so they've been held for 11, 12 years, and you know our government has some concern that they've created jihadists, and I'm not saying that they have. I couldn't tell you if they have, but the bottom line is, even if they had. But somebody hasn't done anything. That puts us to the test as a nation, because that requires us to decide whether or not we're going to hold somebody for their thoughts, for something that they may do in the future. Even though they're not part of Al-Qaeda, not part of Taliban, they're just angry. So the question is, as a nation, are we the kind of people that hold people like that forever? Or do we release people, and if they do something, we deal with them accordingly? I think that we fall into the second category. At least there's no history whatsoever in our long history of holding people for something they may do in the future, especially when they're not part of the enemy fighting force, which again, that's another argument that the government tries to rely on. But they've never given these people any sort of hearing that would determine that they are any sort of reliable or true hearing, you know, where the evidence could be tested, that they are part of an enemy fighting force. So you're dealing with basically, and this goes back to the Bush administration and Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who said, look, we knew we were bringing innocent guys there, and Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, those guys didn't care. They said that's the cost of doing business on the war of terror. We'll hold innocent guys. That they knew this back in 2002, 2003. It disturbed Colin Powell. It disturbed people in the State Department. At the time, they didn't have the voice of the president, obviously.
Well, we're almost out of time, Carlos Warren. I want to thank you first for spending time with us talking about this critical issue. And the last question I have for you is this. You have 130 detainees at Guantanamo that potentially could lose their lives in this protest of the hunger strike. What immediately needs to be done in your mind, and how can our listeners get involved in this process?
Well, first of all, I mean, they should, I mean, if for updates, you can follow me online, because this is, you know, this is what I do. Majority of my professional life is this, and that's it. On Twitter, it's Carlos_Warner, and I put lots of useful stuff on that Twitter. What they should do is first contact their legislatures, write the president. There's a change.org petition, close Guantanamo. They need to be politically active, because this is a political problem. And the first thing they should tell the president is, look, intervene to end the hunger strike. Because it both, at least we want that, and it appears the president wants that. So, I mean, that's an easy one, but it takes him actually doing something. And then get educated, you know, educate your neighbors about who is in Guantanamo, that we don't have the worst of the worst there. That, I mean, you don't take my word for it. Go look online, see who the 86 are, you know, see who's hunger striking. Just read what has been written in the past 2 months. And I think with the majority of people, even people that come from the right, view this problem as once they get get educated, is that there's a lot of agreement there. Let's free the innocent. Let's try the rest. And if you can just do that with your neighbor, educate your neighbor about who's in Guantanamo, you're helping closing this, because the president needs to feel that, you know, the American public wants this. He's a politician first.
All right. Well, Carlos, you certainly have an important role to play in this crisis, and I appreciate you taking time out to speak with us and educate us about it as a defense attorney for 11 of those Guantanamo detainees. So I hope we can stay in touch with you, because it's an important source of information for a lot of people.
Anytime. It's my pleasure, and thank you for having me and paying attention to this problem.
Thanks, Carlos. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
That's Carlos Warner, an assistant federal defender representing 11 men held without charge or trial at the U.S. Guantanamo Naval Detention Camp in Cuba. Many of those, now 130 estimated, are on a hunger strike, many of them being force-fed.